him, but the delay may cause your friend to pass an uneasy night, and therefore we had better go with all speed to extricate him from the hands of the infidels. Are you still resolved to accompany me, more determined than ever? Well then, come along. Franz and the Count went downstairs accompanied by Peppino. At the door they found the carriage. Ali was on the box, in whom Franz recognized the dumb slave of the Grotto of Monte Cristo. Franz and the Count got into the carriage. Peppino placed himself beside Ali, and they set off at a rapid pace. After quitting the city, the road which the carriage traversed was the ancient Appian Way, which is bordered with tombs. From time to time, by the light of the moon which began to rise, Franz imagined that he saw something like a sentinel appear from various points of the ruin and suddenly retreat into the darkness on a signal from Peppino. A short time before they reached the circus of Caracalla, the carriage stopped. Peppino opened the door, and the Count and Franz alighted. "In 10 minutes," said the Count to his companion, "we shall arrive there." He then took Peppino aside, gave him some order in a low voice, and Peppino went away, taking with him a torch brought with them in the carriage. 5 minutes elapsed, during which Franz saw the shepherd advance along a narrow path in the midst of the irregular ground, which forms the irregular and broken surface of the Campagna, and disappear in the midst of the high red herbage, which seemed like the bristling mane of some enormous lion. "Now," said the Count, "let us follow him." They came to an opening behind a clump of bushes and in the midst of a pile of rocks by which a man could scarcely pass. Peppino glided first into this crevice, but after advancing a few paces, the passage widened. Then he paused, lighted his torch, and turned round to see if they came after him. The Count first reached a kind of square space, and Franz followed him closely. The earth sloped in a gentle descent, enlarging as they proceeded. Still, Franz and the Count were compelled to advance stooping and scarcely able to proceed 2 abreast. They went on 150 paces thus, and then were stopped by, "Who goes there?" At the same time they saw the reflection of a torch on the barrel of a carbine. "A friend," responded Peppino, and, advancing alone towards the sentry, he said a few words to him in a low tone, and then he, like the first, saluted the nocturnal visitors, making a sign that they might proceed. Behind the sentinel was a staircase with 20 steps. Franz and the Count descended these, and found themselves in a kind of crossroads, forming a burial ground. 5 roads diverged like the rays of a star, and the walls, dug into niches, placed one above the other in the shape of coffins, showed that they were at last in the catacombs. In one of the cavities, whose extent it was impossible to determine, some rays of light were visible. The Count laid his hand on Franz's shoulder. "Would you like to see a camp of bandits in repose?" he inquired. "Exceedingly," replied Franz. "Come with me, then. Peppino, extinguish the torch." Peppino obeyed, and Franz and the Count were suddenly in utter darkness, only that 50 paces in advance of them there played along the wall some reddish beams of light, more visible since Peppino had put out his torch. They advanced silently, the Count guiding Franz as if he had the singular faculty of seeing in the dark. Franz himself, however, distinguished his way more plainly in proportion as he advanced towards the rays of light which served them for guides. 3 arcades, of which the middle served as the door, offered themselves. These arcades opened on one side to the corridor, in which were the Count and Franz, and on the other to a large square chamber, entirely surrounded by niches similar to those of which we have spoken. In the midst of this chamber were 4 stones, which had formerly served as an altar, as was evident from the cross which still surmounted them. A lamp, placed at the base of a pillar, lighted up with its pale and flickering flame the singular scene which presented itself to the eyes of the 2 visitors concealed in the shadow. A man was seated with his elbow leaning on the column, and was reading with his back turned to the arcades, through the openings of which the newcomers contemplated him. This was the chief of the band, Luigi Vampa. Around him, and in groups, according to their fancy, lying in their mantles or with their backs against a kind of stone bench which went all round the columbarium, were to be seen 20 brigands or more, each having his carbine within reach. At the bottom, silent, scarcely visible, and like a shadow, was a sentinel, who was walking up and down before a kind of opening, which was only distinguishable because, in that spot, the darkness seemed thicker. When the Count thought France had gazed sufficiently on this picturesque tableau, he raised his finger to his lips to warn him to be silent, and, ascending the three steps which led to the corridor of the columbarium, entered the chamber by the centre arcade, and advanced towards Vampa, who was so intent on the book before him that he did not hear the noise of his footsteps. "Who goes there?" cried the sentinel, less occupied, and who saw by the lamp's light a shadow which approached his chief. At this sound, Vampa rose quickly, drawing at the same moment a pistol from his girdle. In a moment, all the bandits were on their feet, and 20 carbines were levelled at the Count. "Well," said he, in a voice perfectly calm, and no muscle of his countenance disturbed, "well, my dear Vampa, it appears to me that you receive a friend with a great deal of ceremony." "Ground arms!" exclaimed the chief, with an imperative sign of the hand, whilst with the other he took off his hat respectfully. Then, turning to the singular personage who had caused this scene, he said, "Your pardon, Monsieur le Comte, but I was so far from expecting the honour of a visit that I did not really recognise you." "It seems that your memory is equally short in everything, Vampa," said the Count, "and that not only do you forget people's faces, but also the conditions you make with them." "What conditions have I forgotten, Monsieur le Comte?" inquired the bandit, with the air of a man who, having committed an error, is anxious to repair it. "Was it not agreed," asked the Count, "that not only my person, but also that of my friends, should be respected by you?" "And how have I broken that treaty, Your Excellency? You have this evening carried off and conveyed hither the Vicomte Albert de Morcerf." "Well," continued the Count, in a tone that made France shudder, "this young gentleman is one of my friends. This young gentleman lodges in the same hotel as myself. This young gentleman has been up and down the Corso for 8 hours in my private carriage, and yet, I repeat to you, you have carried him off and conveyed him hither, and," added the Count, taking the letter from his pocket, "you have set a ransom on him, as if he were an indifferent person." "Why did you not tell me all this, you?" inquired the brigand chief, turning towards his men, who all retreated before his look. "Why have you exposed me thus to fail in my word towards a gentleman like the Count, who has all our lives in his hands? By heavens, if I thought one of you knew that the young gentleman was the friend of His Excellency, I would blow his brains out with my own hands." "Well," said the Count, turning towards France, "I told you, there was some mistake in this." "Are you not alone?" asked Vampa, with uneasiness. "I am with the person to whom this letter was addressed, and to whom I desired to prove that Luigi Vampa was a man of his word. Come, Your Excellency, here is Luigi Vampa, who will himself express to you his deep regret at the mistake he has committed." France approached, the chief advancing several steps to meet him. "Welcome amongst us, Your Excellency," he said to him. "You heard what the Count just said, and also my reply. Let me add that I would not for the 4,000 piastres at which I had fixed your friend's ransom that this had happened." "But," said Franz, looking around him uneasily, "where is the Viscount? I do not see him." "Nothing has happened to him, I hope," said the Count, frowningly. "The prisoner is there," replied Vampa, pointing to the hollow place in front of which the bandit was on guard, "and I will go myself and tell him he is free." The chief went towards the place he had pointed out as Albert's prison, and Franz and the Count followed him. "What is the prisoner doing?" inquired Vampa of the sentinel. "Ma foi, captain," replied the sentry, "I do not know. For the last hour I have not heard him stir." "Come in, Your Excellency," said Vampa. The Count and Franz ascended 7 or 8 steps after the chief, who drew back a bolt and opened a door. Then, by the gleam of a lamp, similar to that which lighted the columbarium, Albert was to be seen wrapped up in a cloak which one of the bandits had lent him, lying in a corner, in profound slumber. "Come," said the Count, smiling with his own peculiar smile, "not so bad for a man who is to be shot at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning." Vampa looked at Albert with a kind of admiration. He was not insensible to such a proof of courage. "You are right, Monsieur Le Comte," he said. "This must be one of your friends." Then going to Albert, he touched him on the shoulder, saying, "Will Your Excellency please to awaken?" Albert stretched out his arms, rubbed his eyelids, and opened his eyes. "Ah, ah," said he, "is it you, Captain? You should have allowed me to have slept. I had such a delightful dream. I was dancing the galop at Tolonia's with the Countess G." Then he drew from his pocket his watch, which he had preserved, that he might see how time sped. "1:30 only?" said he. "Why the devil do you rouse me at this hour?" "To tell you that you are free, Your Excellency." "My dear fellow," replied Albert, with perfect ease of mind, "remember for the future Napoleon's maxim, never awaken me but for bad news. If you had let me sleep on, I should have finished my galop, and have been grateful to you all my life. So then they have paid my ransom." "No, Your Excellency." "Well then, how am I free? A person to whom I can refuse nothing has come to demand you." Albert looked round and perceived France. "What?" said he. "Is it you, my dear France, whose devotion and friendship are thus displayed?" "No, not I," replied France, "but our neighbor, the Count of Monte Cristo." "Ah, ah, Monsieur Le Comte," said Albert gaily, and arranging his cravat and waistbands, "you are really most kind, and I hope you will consider me as eternally obliged to you, in the first place for the carriage, and in the next for this." And he put out his hand to the Count, who shuddered as he gave his own, but who nevertheless did give it. The bandit gazed on this scene with amazement. He was evidently accustomed to see his prisoners tremble before him, and yet here was one whose gay temperament was not for a moment altered. As for France, he was enchanted at the way in which Albert had sustained the national honor in the presence of the bandit. "My dear Albert," he said, "if you will make haste, we shall yet have time to finish the night at Tolonia's. You may conclude your interrupted galop, so that you will owe no ill will to Signor Luigi, who has, indeed, throughout this whole affair, acted like a gentleman." "You are decidedly right, and we may reach the palazzo at 2:00. Signor Luigi," continued Albert, "is there any formality to fulfill before I take leave of Your Excellency?" "None, sir," replied the bandit. "You are as free as air." "Well, then, a happy and merry life to you. Come, gentlemen, come." And Albert, followed by Franz and the Count, descended the staircase, crossed the square chamber where stood all the bandits, hat in hand. "Peppino," said the brigand chief, "give me the torch." "What are you going to do then?" inquired the Count. "I will show you the way back myself," said the captain. "That is the least honor I can testify to Your Excellency." And taking the lighted torch from the hand of the herdsman, he preceded his guests, not as a servant who performs an act of civility, but like a king who precedes ambassadors. On reaching the door, he bowed. "And now, Monsieur Le Comte," added he, "allow me to repeat my apologies, and I hope you will not entertain any resentment at what has occurred." "No, my dear Vampa," replied the Count. "Besides, you compensate for your mistakes in so gentlemanly a way that one almost feels obliged to you for having committed them. Gentlemen," added the chief, turning towards the young men, "perhaps the offer may not appear very tempting to you, but if you should ever feel inclined to pay me a second visit, wherever I may be, you shall be welcome." Franz and Albert bowed. The Count went out first, then Albert. Franz paused for a moment. "Has Your Excellency anything to ask me?" said Vampa, with a smile. "Yes, I have," replied Franz. "I am curious to know what work you were perusing with so much attention as we entered." "Caesar's Commentaries," said the bandit. "It is my favorite work." "Well, are you coming?" asked Albert. "Yes," replied Franz. "Here I am." And he, in his turn, left the caves. They advanced to the plain. "Now, Monsieur Le Comte," Albert said, "let us on with all the speed we may. I am enormously anxious to finish my night at the Duke of Bracciano's." They found the carriage where they had left it. The Count said a word in Arabic to Ali, and the horses went off at great speed. It was just 2 o'clock by Albert's watch when the two friends entered into the dancing room. Their return was quite an event, but as they entered together, all uneasiness on Albert's account ceased instantly. "Madame," said the Viscount Morcerf, advancing towards the Countess, "yesterday you were so condescending as to promise me a galop. I am rather late in claiming this gracious promise, but here is my friend, whose character for veracity you well know, and he will assure you the delay arose from no fault of mine." And as, at this moment, the music gave the warning for the waltz, Albert put his arm round the waist of the Countess and disappeared with her in the whirl of dancers. In the meantime, Franz was considering the singular shudder that had pervaded the Count of Monte Cristo's frame at the moment when he had been, in some sort, forced to give his hand to Albert.
39. The Rendezvous. Albert's first words to his friend on the following morning contained a request that Franz would accompany him to visit the Count. True, he had warmly and energetically thanked him the previous evening, but services such as he had rendered could never be too often acknowledged. The Count joined them in the saloon. "Monsieur le Comte," said Albert, advancing to meet him, "permit me to repeat the poor thanks I offered last night, and to assure you that the remembrance of all I owe you will never be effaced from my memory. Believe me, while I have life, I shall never cease to dwell with grateful recollection on the prompt and important service you rendered me, as also to remember that to you I am indebted even for my life." "My very good friend and excellent neighbor," replied the Count with a smile, "you really exaggerate my trifling exertions. You owe me nothing but some trifle of 20,000 francs, which you have been saved out of your travelling expenses, so that there is not much of a score between us. But you must really permit me to congratulate you on the ease and unconcern with which you resigned yourself to your fate, and the perfect indifference you manifested as to the turn events might take." "Upon my word," said Albert, "I deserve no credit for what I could not help. Namely, a determination to take everything as I found it, and to let those bandits see that, although men get into troublesome scrapes all over the world, there is no nation but the French can smile, even in the face of grim death himself. All that, however, has nothing to do with my obligations to you, and I now come to ask you whether in my own person, my family, or connections I can in any way serve you. My father, the Comte de Morcerf, although of Spanish origin, possesses considerable influence both at the court of France and Madrid, and I unhesitatingly place the best services of myself and all to whom my life is dear at your disposal."
"Monsieur de Morcerf," replied the Count, "your offer, far from surprising me, is precisely what I expected from you, and I accept it in the same spirit of hearty sincerity with which it is made. Nay, I will go still further and say that I had previously made up my mind to ask a great favour at your hands. Oh, pray, name it. I am wholly a stranger to Paris. It is a city I have never yet seen."
"Is it possible," exclaimed Albert, "that you have reached your present age without visiting the finest capital in the world? I can scarcely credit it. Nevertheless, it is quite true. Still, I agree with you in thinking that my present ignorance of the first city in Europe is a reproach to me in every way, and calls for immediate correction. But in all probability, I should have performed so important, so necessary a duty as that of making myself acquainted with the wonders and beauties of your justly celebrated capital, had I known any person who would have introduced me into the fashionable world. But unfortunately I possessed no acquaintance there, and of necessity was compelled to abandon the idea. So distinguished an individual as yourself," cried Albert, "could scarcely have required an introduction." "You are most kind. But as regards myself, I can find no merit I possess
save that, as a millionaire, I might have become a partner in the speculations of Monsieur Aguado and Monsieur Rothschild. But as my motive in travelling to your capital would not have been for the pleasure of dabbling in the funds, I stayed away till some favourable chance should present itself of carrying my wish into execution. Your offer, however, smooths all difficulties, and I have only to ask you, my dear Monsieur de Morcerf, these words were accompanied by a most peculiar smile, whether you undertake, upon my arrival in France, to open to me the doors of that fashionable world of which I know no more than a Huron or native of Cochin China.
Oh, that I do, and with infinite pleasure, answered Albert, and so much the more readily as a letter received this morning from my father summons me to Paris in consequence of a treaty of marriage. My dear Franz, do not smile, I beg of you, with a family of high standing and connected with the very elite of Parisian society.
Connected by marriage, you mean, said Franz laughingly. Well, never mind how it is, answered Albert. It comes to the same thing in the end. Perhaps by the time you return to Paris, I shall be quite a sober, staid father of a family. A most edifying representative I shall make of all the domestic virtues, don't you think so? But as regards your wish to visit our fine city, my dear Count, I can only say that you may command me and mine to any extent you please.
Then it is a settled affair, said the Count, and I give you my solemn assurance that I only waited an opportunity like the present to realize schemes I have long meditated.
Franz doubted not that these schemes were the same concerning which he had dropped some words in the grotto of Monte Cristo, and while the Count gave utterance to the expression, the young man closely examined his features in the hopes that some powerful emotion might render the nature of these projects easily traced upon his expressive countenance. But it was altogether impossible to read the thoughts of the mysterious individual before him, especially when he employed one of those bewildering smiles he so well knew how to call up.
"But tell me now, Count," exclaimed Albert, delighted at the idea of having to chaperon so distinguished a person as Monte Cristo, "tell me truly whether you are in earnest, or if this project of visiting Paris is merely one of those chimerical and uncertain things of which we make so many in the course of our lives, but which, like a house built on the sand, is liable to be blown over by the first puff of wind."
"I pledge you my honour," returned the Count, "that I mean to do as I have said. Both inclination and positive necessity compel me to visit Paris. When do you propose going thither? Have you made up your mind when you shall be there yourself?
Certainly I have. In a fortnight or 3 weeks' time, that is to say, as fast as I can get there.
Nay," said the Count, "I will give you 3 months ere I join you. You see, I make an ample allowance for all delays and difficulties, and in 3 months' time," said Albert, "you will be at my house.
Shall we make a positive appointment for a particular day and hour?" inquired the Count.
"Only let me warn you that I am proverbial for my punctilious exactitude in keeping my engagements."
"The very thing," exclaimed Albert.
"Yes, by all means, let us have this rendezvous duly drawn up and attested."
"So be it, then," replied the Count, and extending his hand towards an almanac suspended near the chimney-piece, he said, "Today is the 21st of February," and drawing out his watch, added, "It is exactly 10:30. Now promise me to remember this, and expect me the 21st of May at the same hour in the forenoon."
"Capital!" exclaimed Albert. "And you shall find everything and everybody ready to receive you. I take upon myself to promise that your breakfast shall be smoking hot, awaiting your arrival.
Where do you live?" "Number 27, Rue d'Ueld."
"Have you bachelor's apartments there? I hope my coming will not put you to any inconvenience. I reside in my father's hotel, but occupy a pavilion at the farther side of the courtyard, entirely separated from the main building."
"Quite sufficient," replied the Count, as, taking out his tablets, he wrote down, "Number 27, Rue d'Ueld, 21st May, 10:30 in the morning.
"Now then," said the Count, returning his tablets to his pocket, "make yourself perfectly easy. The hand of your timepiece will not be more accurate in marking the time than myself."
"Shall I see you again ere my departure?" asked Albert.
"That will be according to circumstances. But when do you set off?"
"Tomorrow evening at 5 o'clock."
"In that case, I must say adieu to you, as I am compelled to go to Naples and shall not return hither before Saturday evening or Sunday morning. And you, Monsieur le Baron," pursued the Count, addressing France, "do you also depart tomorrow?"
"Yes, I go also."
"And whither do you wend your way? To Paris?"
"No, to Venice. I shall remain in Italy for another year or two."
"Then we shall not meet in Paris. I fear I shall not have that honour."
"Well, since we must part," said the Count, holding out a hand to each of the young men, "allow me to wish you a safe and pleasant journey."
It was the first time the hand of France had come in contact with that of the mysterious individual before him, and unconsciously he shuddered at its touch, for it felt cold and icy as that of a corpse.
"Let us understand each other," said Albert. "It is agreed, is it not, that you are to be in the Rue du Helder on the 21st of May at 10:30 in the morning, and your word of honour passed for your punctuality?"
"All that is settled and arranged upon honour," replied the Count.
"Rely upon seeing me at the time and place agreed on."
The young men then rose, and courteously bowing to their singular acquaintance, quitted the room.
"What is the matter?" asked Albert of France when they had returned to their own apartments. "You seem more than commonly thoughtful."
"I will confess to you, Albert," replied France, "that I am deeply puzzled to unravel the real character of this strange Count, and the appointment you have made to meet him in Paris fills me with 1,000 apprehensions."
"My dear fellow," exclaimed Albert, "what can there possibly be in that to excite uneasiness? Why, you must have lost your senses to imagine either harm or danger can spring from it."
"Whether I am in my senses or not," answered France, "such is my view of the evil effects that may arise from a second meeting with this incomprehensible Count, that I would give much you had not crossed his path."
"Listen to me, France," said Albert. "I am not sorry that our present conversation gives me an opportunity of remarking to you how much I have been struck with the difference of your manner towards the Count to that with which you treat your friends in general. To him you are frigid and polite, while to myself, for instance, you are warm and cordial as a friend should be. Have you any private reasons for so acting?"
"Possibly."
"Did you ever meet him previous to coming hither?"
"I have. And where?
Will you promise me not to repeat a single word of what I am about to tell you?"
"I promise you to observe the utmost secrecy."
"And you pledge me your honour that nothing shall induce you to divulge it?"
"I pledge my honour."
"Then listen to me."
Franz then related to his friend the history of his excursion to the Isle of Monte Cristo, and of his finding a party of smugglers there, with whom were two Corsican bandits. He dwelt with considerable force and energy on the almost magical hospitality he had received from the Count, and the magnificence of his entertainment in the Grotto of the 1,001 Nights. He recounted with circumstantial exactitude all particulars of the supper, the hashish, the statues, the dream, and reality, and how at his awakening there remained no proof or trace of all these events, save the small yacht seen in the distant horizon, hastening with spread sails towards Porto Vecchio. Then he detailed the conversation overheard by him at the Colosseum between the mysterious visitant Vampa, in which the Count had promised to obtain the release of the bandit Peppino, an engagement which, as our readers are aware, he most faithfully fulfilled. At last he arrived at the adventure of the preceding night, and the embarrassment in which he found himself placed by not having sufficient cash to complete the sum of 600 or 700 piastres, with the circumstance of his having applied to the Count to furnish the money in which he was deficient, an impulse which had led to results so picturesque and satisfactory. Albert listened with the most profound attention.
"Well," said he, when Franz had concluded, "what do you find to object to in all you have related?
The Count is fond of travelling, and being rich possesses a vessel of his own. Go but to Portsmouth or Southampton, and you will find the harbours crowded with the yachts belonging to such of the English as can afford the expense and have the same liking for this amusement as your mysterious acquaintance of the Isle of Monte Cristo. Now, by way of having a resting place during his excursions, avoiding the wretched cookery which has been trying its best to poison me during the last 4 months, while you have manfully resisted its effects for as many years, and obtaining a bed on which it is impossible to slumber, Monte Cristo has furnished for himself a temporary abode where you first found him. But to prevent the possibility of the Tuscan government taking a fancy to his enchanted palace, and thereby depriving him of the advantages naturally expected from so large an outlay of capital, he has wisely enough purchased the island and assumed the title of its count. Just ask yourself, my good fellow, whether there are not many persons of our acquaintance who assume the names of lands and properties they never in their lives were master of. But, said Franz, how do you account for the circumstance of the Corsican bandits being among the crew of his vessel? Why, really, the thing seems to me simple enough. Nobody knows better than yourself that the bandits of Corsica are not rogues or thieves, but purely and simply fugitives, driven by some sinister motive from their native town or village, and that their fellowship involves no disgrace or stigma. For my own part, I protest that should I ever visit Corsica, my first visit, ere even I presented myself to the mayor or prefect, should be to the bandits of Colomba, if I could only manage to find them, for on my conscience they are a race of men I admire greatly. Still, persisted France, I suppose you will allow that such men as Vampa and his band are regular villains, who have no other motive than plunder when they seize your person. How do you explain the influence the Count evidently possessed over those ruffians? My good friend, as in all probability I owe my present safety to that influence, it would ill become me to search too closely into its source. Therefore, instead of condemning him for his intimacy with outlaws, you must give me leave to excuse any little irregularity there may be in such a connection. Not altogether for preserving my life, for my own idea is that it never was in much danger, but certainly for saving me 4,000 piastres, which, being translated, means neither more nor less than 24,000 livres of our money. Can you tell me, replied France, what country produced this mysterious person? What is his native tongue, his means of existence, and from whence does he derive his immense fortune? And what were those events of his early life, a life as marvellous as unknown, that have tinctured his succeeding years with so dark and gloomy a misanthropy? Certainly these are questions that, in your place, I should like to have answered, my dear Franz, replied Albert, when, upon receipt of my letter, you found the necessity of asking the Count's assistance. You promptly went to him, saying, my friend Albert de Morcerf is in danger. Help me to deliver him. Was not that nearly what you said? It was. Well, then, did he ask you, who is Monsieur Albert de Morcerf? How does he come by his name, his fortune? What are his means of existence? What is his birthplace? Of what country is he a native? Tell me, did he put all these questions to you? I confess he asked me none. No, he merely came and freed me from the hands of Signor Vampa, where I can assure you, spite of all my outward appearance of ease and unconcern, I did not very particularly care to remain. Now then, France, when, in return for services so promptly and unhesitatingly rendered, he but asks me in return to do for him what is done daily for any Russian prince or Italian noble who may pass through Paris, merely to introduce him into society, would you have me refuse? My good fellow, you must have lost your senses to think it possible I could act with such cold-blooded policy. And this time it must be confessed that in direct opposition to the ordinary discussion between the young men, all the good and powerful reasons were on Albert's side. The following afternoon at 5:30, the young men parted, Albert de Morcerf to return to Paris, and Franz d'Epernay to pass a fortnight at Venice. but ere he entered his travelling carriage, Albert, in the fear of his expected guest forgetting the engagement he had entered into, placed in the care of the waiter of the hotel a card to be delivered to the Count of Monte Cristo, on which, beneath the name of Albert de Morcerf, he had written in pencil, 27, Rue du Helder, on the 21st May, 10:30 a.m.
40. The Guests. In the house in the Rue du Helder, where Albert had invited the Count of Monte Cristo, everything was being prepared on the morning of the 21st of May to fulfill the engagement. Albert de Morcerf inhabited a pavilion situated at the corner of a large court and directly opposite another building in which were the servants' apartments. Two windows only of the pavilion faced the street. Three other windows looked into the court, and two at the back into the garden. Between the court and the garden, built in the heavy style of the imperial architecture, was the large and fashionable dwelling of the Comte and Comtesse de Morcerf. A high wall surrounded the whole of the hotel, surmounted at intervals by vases filled with flowers, and broken in the centre by a large gate of gilt iron, which served as the carriage entrance. A small door, close to the lodge of the concierge, gave ingress and egress to the servants and masters when they were on foot. It was easy to discover that the delicate care of a mother, unwilling to part from her son, and yet aware he required the full exercise of his liberty, had chosen this habitation for Albert. On the other hand, was visible the intelligent independence of youth, enchanted with the free and idle life of a young man. By means of these two windows looking into the street, Albert could see all that passed. The sight of what is going on is so necessary to young men who wish always to see the world traverse their horizon, be that horizon but the street only. Then, should anything appear to merit a more minute examination, Albert de Morcerf could follow up his researches by means of a small gate, similar to that close to the concierge's door, and which merits a particular description. It was a little entrance that seemed never to have been opened since the house was built, so entirely was it covered with dust and dirt. But the well-oiled hinges and lock announced a frequent and mysterious employment. This door laughed at the concierge, from whose vigilance and jurisdiction it escaped, opening, like the door in the Arabian Nights, the open sesame of Ali Baba, by a cabalistic word or a concerted tap without, from the sweetest voices or whitest fingers in the world. At the end of a long corridor with which the door communicated, and which formed the antechamber, was, on the right, Albert's breakfast room, looking into the court, and on the left, the saloon, looking into the garden. Shrubs and creeping plants covered the windows and hid from the garden and court these two apartments, the only rooms into which, as they were on the ground floor, the prying eyes of the curious could penetrate. On the first floor were the same rooms with the addition of a third, formed out of the antechamber. These three rooms were a salon, a boudoir, and a bedroom. The salon downstairs was only an Algerian divan for the use of smokers. The boudoir upstairs communicated with the bedchamber by an invisible door on the staircase. It was evident every precaution had been taken. Above this floor was a large atelier, which had been increased in size by pulling down the partition, a pandemonium in which the artist and the dandy strove for preeminence. There were collected and piled up all Albert's successive caprices, hunting horns, bass viols, flutes, a whole orchestra, for Albert had had not a taste, but a fancy for music. Easels, palettes, brushes, pencils, for music had been succeeded by painting, foils, boxing gloves, broadswords, and single sticks, for, following the example of the fashionable young men of the time, Albert de Morcerf cultivated with far more perseverance than music and drawing the three arts that complete a dandy's education, i.e., fencing, boxing, and single stick. And it was in this apartment that he received Grisier, Cook, and Charles Lacour. The rest of the furniture of this privileged apartment consisted of old cabinets of the time of Francis I, filled with China and Japan vases, earthenware from Lucca or Robbia, plates of Bernard de Palissy, of old armchairs in which had perhaps reposed themselves Henri IV or Sully, Louis XIII or Richelieu, for two of these armchairs, adorned with a carved shield on which were engraved the fleur-de-lis of France on an azure field, evidently came from the Louvre, or at least some royal residence. On these dark and sombre chairs were thrown splendid stuffs, dyed beneath Persia's sun, or woven by the fingers of the women of Calcutta or of Chandernagore. What these stuffs did there it was impossible to say. They awaited, whilst gratifying the eyes, a destination unknown to their owner himself. In the meantime, they filled the room with their golden and silky reflections. In the centre of the room was a piano of rosewood, of Rolla and Blanchet, of small dimensions but containing an orchestra in its narrow and sonorous cavity, and groaning beneath the weight of the chef d'oeuvre of Beethoven, Weber, Mozart, Haydn, Grétry and Porpora. On the walls, over the doors, on the ceiling, were swords, daggers, Malay creeses, maces, battle-axes, suits of armour, gilded, damasked, and inlaid, dried plants, minerals, and stuffed birds, opening their flame-coloured wings as if for flight, and their beaks that never close. This was the favourite sitting-room of Albert. However, the morning of the appointment, the young man had established himself in the small salon downstairs. There, on a table, surrounded at some distance by a large and luxurious divan, every species of tobacco known, from the yellow tobacco of Petersburg to the black tobacco of Sinai, the Maryland, the Puerto Rico, and the Latakia, was exposed in those pots of crackled earthenware of which the Dutch are so fond. Beside them, in boxes of fragrant wood, were ranged according to their size and quality, Pueros, Regalias, Havanas, and Manilas. And in an open cabinet a collection of German pipes, of chibouks with their amber mouthpieces ornamented with coral, and of narghilas with their long tubes of Morocco, awaited the caprice or the sympathy of the smokers. Albert had himself presided at the arrangement, or rather the symmetrical derangement, which, after coffee, the guests at a breakfast of modern days love to contemplate through the vapour that escapes from their mouth and ascends in long and fanciful wreaths to the ceiling. At 9:45, a valet entered. He composed, with a little groom named John, and who only spoke English, all Albert's establishment, although the cook of the hotel was always at his service, and on great occasions the Count's chasseur also. This valet, whose name was Germain, and who enjoyed the entire confidence of his young master, held in one hand a number of papers, and in the other a packet of letters which he gave to Albert. Albert glanced carelessly at the different missives, selected two written in a small and delicate hand and enclosed in scented envelopes, opened them, and perused their contents with some attention. "How did these letters come?" said he. "One by the post. Madame Danglars' footman left the other. Let Madame Danglars know that I accept the place she offers me in her box. Wait. Then, during the day, tell Rosa that when I leave the opera, I will sup with her, as she wishes. Take her 6 bottles of different wine, Cyprus, Sherry, and Malaga, and a barrel of Ostend oysters. Get them at Borel's, and be sure you say they are for me. At 1:00, sir, do you breakfast? What time is it now? 9:45. Very well. At 10:30. Debray will perhaps be obliged to go to the minister, and besides," Albert looked at his tablets, "it is the hour I told the Count, 21st May at 10:30, and though I do not much rely upon his promise, I wish to be punctual. Is Madame la Comtesse up yet? If Monsieur le Vicomte wishes, I will inquire. Yes. Ask her for one of her liqueur cellarets. Mine is incomplete. And tell her I shall have the honour of seeing her about 3:00, and that I request permission to introduce someone to her." The valet left the room. Albert threw himself on the divan, tore off the cover of 2 or 3 of the papers, looked at the playbills, made a face at perceiving they played an opera and not a ballet, hunted vainly amongst the advertisements for a new tooth powder of which he had heard, and threw down, one after the other, the 3 leading papers of Paris, muttering, "These papers become more and more stupid every day."
A moment after, a carriage stopped before the door, and the servant announced Monsieur Lucien de Bray, a tall young man with light hair, clear grey eyes, and thin and compressed lips, dressed in a blue coat with buttons of gold beautifully carved, a white neckcloth, and a tortoiseshell eyeglass suspended by a silken thread, and which, by an effort of the superciliary and zygomatic nerves he fixed in his eye, entered with a half-official air, without smiling or speaking. "Good morning, Lucien. Good morning," said Albert. "Your punctuality really alarms me. What do I say? Punctuality? You, whom I expected last, you arrive at 10:05, when the time fixed was 10:30. Have ministers resigned?" "No, my dear fellow," returned the young man, seating himself on the divan. "Reassure yourself. We are tottering always, but we never fall. And I begin to believe that we shall pass into a state of immobility, and then the affairs of the peninsula will completely consolidate us." "Ah, true. You drive Don Carlos out of Spain." "No, no, my dear fellow, do not confound our plans. We take him to the other side of the French frontier and offer him hospitality at Bourges." "At Bourges? Yes. He has not much to complain of. Bourges is the capital of Charles VII. Do you not know that all Paris knew it yesterday, and the day before it had already transpired on the Bourse, and Monsieur Danglars, I do not know by what means that man contrives to obtain intelligence as soon as we do, made £1,040,000. "And you another order, for I see you have a blue riband at your buttonhole." "Yes, they sent me the order of Charles III, returned Debray carelessly. "Come, do not affect indifference, but confess you were pleased to have it." "Oh, it is very well as a finish to the toilette. It looks very neat on a black coat buttoned up." "Well, I am going to amuse you by introducing to you a new acquaintance. A man or a woman?" "A man. I know so many already." "But you do not know this man. Where does he come from? The end of the world? Farther still, perhaps. The devil. I hope he does not bring our breakfast with him." "Oh, no. Our breakfast comes from my father's kitchen." "Are you hungry?" "Humiliating as such a confession is, I am. But I dined at Monsieur de Villefort's, and lawyers always give you very bad dinners. You would think they felt some remorse. Did you ever remark that?" "Ah, depreciate other persons' dinners. You ministers give such splendid ones." "Yes, but we do not invite people of fashion. If we were not forced to entertain a parcel of country boobies because they think and vote with us, we should never dream of dining at home, I assure you." "Well, take a glass of sherry and a biscuit." "Willingly. Your Spanish wine is excellent. You see, we were quite right to pacify that country." "Yes, but Don Carlos?" "Well, Don Carlos will drink Bordeaux, and in 10 years we will marry his son to the little queen. You will then obtain the golden fleece if you are still in the ministry. I think, Albert, you have adopted the system of feeding me on smoke this morning." "Well, you must allow it is the best thing for the stomach. But I hear Beauchamp in the next room. You can dispute together, and that will pass away the time." "About what?" "About the papers." "My dear friend," said Lucien, with an air of sovereign contempt, "do I ever read the papers?" "Then you will dispute the more." "Monsieur Beauchamp," announced the servant. "Enter, enter," said Albert, rising and advancing to meet the young man. "Here is Debray, who detests you without reading you, so he says." "He is quite right," returned Beauchamp, "for I criticize him without knowing what he does." "Good day, Commander." "Ah, you know that already," said the private secretary, smiling and shaking hands with him. "And what do they say of it in the world?" "They say that it is quite fair, and that you sow so much red that you must reap a little blue." "Come, come, that is not bad," said Lucien. "Why do you not join our party, my dear Beauchamp? With your talents you would make your fortune in 3 or 4 years. I only await one thing before following your advice, that is, a minister who will hold office for 6 months. My dear Albert, one word, for I must get poor Lucien a respite. Do we breakfast or dine? I must go to the chamber, for our life is not an idle one. You only breakfast. I await two persons, and the instant they arrive, we shall sit down to table.
41. The breakfast.
And what sort of persons do you expect to breakfast? Said Beauchamp.
A gentleman and a diplomatist.
Then we shall have to wait 2 hours for the gentleman and 3 for the diplomatist. I shall come back to dessert. Keep me some strawberries, coffee, and cigars. I shall take a cutlet on my way to the chambers. Do not do anything of the sort, for were the gentleman a Montmorency and the diplomatist a Metternich, we will breakfast at 11. In the meantime, follow Debray's example and take a glass of sherry and a biscuit.
Be it so. I will stay. I must do something to distract my thoughts.
You are like Debray, and yet it seems to me that when the minister is out of spirits, the opposition ought to be joyous.
Ah, you do not know with what I am threatened. I shall hear this morning Monsieur Danglars make a speech at the Chamber of Deputies, and at his wife's this evening I shall hear the tragedy of a peer of France. The devil take the constitutional government. And since we had our choice, as they say at least, how could we choose that?
I understand. You must lay in a stock of hilarity. Do not run down Monsieur Danglars' speeches, said Debray. He votes for you, for he belongs to the opposition.
Pardieu, that is exactly the worst of all. I am waiting until you send him to speak of the Luxembourg to laugh at my ease.
My dear friend, said Albert to Beauchamp, it is plain the affairs of Spain are settled, for you are most desperately out of humour this morning. Recollect that Parisian gossip has spoken of a marriage between myself and Mademoiselle Eugénie Danglars. I cannot in conscience, therefore, let you run down the speeches of a man who will one day say to me, Monsieur le Vicomte, you know I give my daughter 80,000 pounds.
Ah, this marriage will never take place, said Beauchamp. The king has made him a baron and can make him a peer, but he cannot make him a gentleman, and the Comte de Morcerf is too aristocratic to consent for the paltry sum of 80,000 pounds to a mésalliance. The Vicomte de Morcerf can only wed a marchioness.
But 80,000 pounds is a nice little sum, replied Morcerf.
Monsieur de Chateau Renaud, Monsieur Maximilian Morel, said the servant, announcing 2 fresh guests.
Now then, to breakfast, said Beauchamp, for if I remember, you told me you only expected 2 persons, Albert.
Morel? Muttered Albert. Morel? Who is he? But before he had finished, Monsieur de Chateau Renaud, a handsome young man of 30, gentleman all over, that is, with the figure of a Guiche and the wit of a Mortemart, took Albert's hand. My dear Albert, said he, let me introduce you to Monsieur Maximilian Morel, captain of Spahi, my friend, and what is more, however the man speaks for himself, my preserver. Salute my hero, Viscount. And he stepped on one side, exhibiting the large and open brow, the piercing eyes and black moustache of the fine and noble young man whom our readers have already seen at Marseilles, under circumstances sufficiently dramatic not to be forgotten. A rich uniform, half French, half Oriental, set off his broad chest, decorated with the Order of the Legion of Honour, and his graceful and stalwart figure. The young officer bowed with easy and elegant politeness.
Monsieur, said Albert with affectionate courtesy, Monsieur le Comte de Chateau Renaud knew how much pleasure this introduction would give me. You are his friend, be ours also.
Well said, interrupted Chateau Renaud, and pray that if you should ever be in a similar predicament, he may do as much for you as he did for me.
What has he done? Asked Albert.
Oh, nothing worth speaking of, said Morel. Monsieur de Chateau Renaud exaggerates.
Not worth speaking of, cried Chateau Renaud. Life is not worth speaking of. That is rather too philosophical, on my word, Morel. It is very well for you who risk your life every day, but for me who only did so once, what is evident in all this, Baron, is that Monsieur le Capitaine Morel saved your life.
Exactly so.
On what occasion?
asked Beauchamp. "Beauchamp, my good fellow, you know I am starving," said Debray. "Do not set him off on some long story." "Well, I do not prevent your sitting down to table," replied Beauchamp. "Château Renaud can tell us whilst we eat our breakfast." "Gentlemen," said Morcerf, "it is only 10:15, and I expect someone else."
"Ah, true, a diplomatist," observed Debray.
"I know not whether he be or not. I only know that I gave him a mission which he terminated so entirely to my satisfaction that had I been king, I should have instantly created him knight of all my orders, even had I been able to offer him the golden fleece and the garter."
"Well, since we are not to sit down to table," said Debray, "take a glass of sherry and tell us all about it."
"You all know that I had the fancy of going to Africa. It is a road your ancestors have traced for you," said Albert gallantly.
"Yes, but I doubt that your object was like theirs, to rescue the Holy Sepulchre."
"You are quite right, Beauchamp," observed the young aristocrat. "It was only to fight as an amateur. I cannot bear duelling ever since 2 seconds, whom I had chosen to accommodate a quarrel, forced me to break the arm of one of my best friends, one whom you all know, poor France d'Epernay."
"Ah, true," said Debray. "You did fight some time ago. About what?"
"The devil take me if I remember," returned Château Renaud. "But I recollect perfectly one thing, that, being unwilling to let such talents as mine sleep, I wished to try upon the Arabs the new pistols that had been given to me. In consequence, I embarked for Iran, and went from thence to Constantine, where I arrived just in time to witness the raising of the siege. I retreated with the rest during 8:40. I endured the rain during the day and the cold during the night tolerably well, but the third morning my horse died of cold. Poor brute, accustomed to be covered up and to have a stove in the stable, an Arabian finds himself unable to bear 10 degrees of cold in Arabia."
"That's why you want to purchase my English horse," said Debray. "You think he will bear the cold better. You are mistaken, for I have made a vow never to return to Africa."
"You were very much frightened, then?" asked Beauchamp.
"I confess it, and I had good reason to be so," replied Château Renaud. "I was retreating on foot, for my horse was dead. 6 Arabs came up full gallop to cut off my head. I shot 2 with my double-barrel gun, and 2 more with my pistols, but I was then disarmed, and 2 were still left. One seized me by the hair, that is why I now wear it so short, for no one knows what may happen. The other encircled my neck with a yatagan, when this gentleman whom you see here charged them, shot the one who held me by the hair with a pistol, and cleft the skull of the other with his sabre. He had assigned himself the task of saving the life of a man that day. Chance caused that man to be myself. When I am rich, I will order a statue of Chance from Klugman or Marochetti."
"Yes," said Morel, smiling. "It was the 5th of September, the anniversary of the day on which my father was miraculously preserved. Therefore, as far as it lies in my power, I endeavour to celebrate it by some heroic action," interrupted Château Renaud.
"I was chosen. But this is not all. After rescuing me from the sword, he rescued me from the cold, not by sharing his cloak with me, like Saint-Martin, but by giving me it all. Then from hunger, by sharing with me, guess what?"
"A Strasbourg pie?" asked Beauchamp.
"No. His horse, of which we each of us ate a slice with a hearty appetite. It was very hard."
"The horse?" said Morcerf, laughing.
"No, the sacrifice," returned Château Renaud. "Ask Debray if he would sacrifice his English steed for a stranger."
"Not for a stranger," said Debray, "but for a friend. I might, perhaps."
"I divined that you would become mine, Monsieur le Comte," replied Morel. "Besides, as I had the honour to tell you, heroism or not, sacrifice or not, that day I owed an offering to bad fortune in recompense for the favours good fortune had on other days granted to us.
The history to which Monsieur Morel alludes, continued Chateau Renaud, is an admirable one, which he will tell you some day when you are better acquainted with him. Today, let us fill our stomachs and not our memories. What time do you breakfast, Albert?
At 10:30.
Precisely? Asked Debray, taking out his watch. Oh, you will give me 5 minutes' grace, replied Morcerf, for I also expect a preserver.
And where does he come from? Asked Debray.
You have already answered the question once, but so vaguely that I venture to put it a second time.
Really? Said Albert. I do not know. When I invited him 3 months ago, he was then at Rome, but since that time, who knows where he may have gone?
And you think him capable of being exact? Demanded Debray.